If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
Jimmy Carter is lying in state at the Carter Center in Atlanta. People continue to file by the casket. Back in 2015, Jimmy Carter joined us at WGN to promote his book at the time called A Full Life, Reflections at 90. And we had a pretty interesting conversation, including some marriage advice from the former president. And we talked about some of his proudest moments. And also, Marianne asked about dealing with the inevitable adversity that life brings all of us. The 39th president of the United States, Jimmy Carter. His new book is called A Full Life, Reflections at 90. And we are very pleased to have President Carter with us right now. Good afternoon, sir.
Hi.
Well, it's good to be with both of you. Thank you.
We were going to start by playing Hail to the Chief, but I remembered that when you were president, you didn't like that when they did that, did you?
No, it was excessive. But when I cut it out, I had a lot of complaints from the American public who really liked the royalty aspect of the presidency sometimes.
I remember.
By the way, you sound so great. You write in your book that the life you have now at 90 is the best time. You're still active as ever with the Carter Center. You and Rosalind have visited more than 145 countries. You've been blessed with good health. And you say you look to the future with eagerness and with confidence, but you are prepared for inevitable adversity when it comes. How do you prepare for that?
Well, we're deep. Both of us are deeply religious. I teach Sunday school every Sunday. We have a religious foundation to our lives, which is always good when you have setbacks or disappointments or failures or embarrassments or sorrows. And so we're prepared for that part of it. And we have a good place to live. We live in a small town of Plains where both of us were born. Has about 600 people. We have an adequate income, I think, because of my books and because I get a retirement from having been president one time, and I'm also a professor now. So we have a good place to live, good harmony between us, at least for now. We've been together 69 years, as you may know.
Wow.
And so everything right now, we have a very good family. We have about 38 members of our family. We have 12 grandchildren and 10 great-grandchildren, plus a lot of in-laws. So we have a very good kind of a nest in which we can go and hibernate if we want to, and from which we can go and have a lot of fun and adventure and unexpected things to do.
Sounds like you surround yourself by a lot of love. your childhood home was from a model sold in the Sears Roebuck catalog. Was that one of those prefab homes that they sent out from Chicago and you had to build it?
No, it wasn't prefab. It was all cut, though. And the lumber actually came from the place where we lived, but everything else came from Sears Roebuck, including the plans for it and all the doorknobs and doors and windows and things like that. Everything came from Sears. They also sold a model where you could get everything that went into a house delivered in one boxcar on a railroad. And so you could just unload the boxcar and you had an entire house there lying on the ground, and then you had to erect it.
Hmm. After a day of picking cotton, you say in the book that everyone in your family was in bed before 8. You'd lie down in front of the fireplace and turn on the radio. You probably heard some big band remotes from places like Chicago, didn't you?
Well, the one that I always listened to at 8 o'clock was Glenn Miller. He was just on for 15 minutes then. And so I would go to sleep, and we had an alarm clock on the mantelpiece that would go off at 8 o'clock, and I would wake back up, listen to Glenn Miller, and then I would go to bed, too. I would always be the last one in the sack.
You may have heard WGN at that time. In the book, you point out that your decision to quit the Navy and enter politics, along with some other major family decisions, were made without consulting your wife, Rosalind. Now, I couldn't have gotten away with that. How did you?
Well, that was a different time, and I couldn't get away with it now. In fact, for the last, you might say, 50 years of our marriage, we have been complete partners. You know, I don't do anything of importance without consulting her, and vice versa. And I find that my life is much better and better better organized, and I make a lot better decisions now that my wife is involved in making them.
Yeah, I was going to point out to Marianne that I can make decisions on my own. I don't need her input because President Carter worked that way. But I guess I won't do that. Huh?
Yeah, not in the last 50 years.
And it didn't work nearly as well as it does now. I'll say that.
You have nice things to say in the book about Presidents Ford, Bush, 41, and Richard Nixon. But your relationship with Ronald Reagan was strained. Why was that?
Well, I wish it hadn't been, but we had a pretty bitter campaign. And when I went out of the White House and he took over, he just completely ignored me, even when I asked for briefings and if I was going to a foreign country. And as I mentioned in the book, quite often I would get to a foreign country on an official visit by the Carter Center, and the ambassador there would refuse even to acknowledge that I was in the country. That's almost an unheard of thing, but there was some strain after he won the election.
We hear so much about bitter campaigns. They always seem to be bitter and more bitter. Do you think that it's really, is it possible for two candidates to get over it after a bitter campaign?
Well, President Ford and I had a very tough fought battle. By the way, back in those days when I ran against either President Ford or Ronald Reagan, we never did have any negative commercials. We didn't attack each other's character and try to destroy the reputation of each other. We didn't have enough money to start with, but that was just not done back in those days. But after I defeated President Ford and we went to Sadat's funeral together and rode back on the plane, we became, I would say, the closest two friends who ever graduated from the White House. And even the historians say that's true. And so Ford and I had a very intimate relationship, and his wife and my wife were friends, and our children were friends with each other. So the two families, the Ford and Carter family, were just intimate as any friends I've ever had.
Yeah, in the book you write about how Gerald Ford asked if you would give the eulogy at his funeral, and you asked him to do so at yours, didn't you, at that time?
Well, yeah, we called each other pretty often, and one day he called me and I said, Jimmy, my good friend Jimmy is what he called me. Mm-hmm. I've got a special request to make of you. And I said, Jerry, I'll do anything you ask me to within reason. He said, okay, I want you to make the eulogy at my funeral. And I was taken aback.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to talk about it. And I finally said, I thought in a hurry, and I finally said, okay, I'll make the speech at your funeral if you'll make the speech at my funeral. And mm-hmm. so we agreed on that. Mm-hmm. And about 3 months later, he passed away. And that was one of the proud moments of my life, to be requested to go to his home, in his home church, and give the eulogy.
Mr. President, you referred to your presidency as the pinnacle of your political life, but as you point out, it was only 4 of your 90 years, and they don't dominate your chain of memories. At this stage in your life, what memories are the most powerful, the most vivid, and the most emotional?
Well, some of the things that happened when I was president are still very powerful in my memory. Going to Camp David for 13 days, normalizing relations with China, fighting hard in the Senate to get 2/3 vote to approve the Panama Canal treaties. Those things stand out, of course, and going to Camp David on the weekends and being the leader of the greatest nation in the world, all that is very fond memory. But I'd say the best and most vivid memories now are the ones that we have in the 80 countries where the Carter Center has been working since I left the White House. We deal with, this year we'll treat about 71 million people in the world, and all over Africa and Latin America and so forth. And we go into the most remote villages in the jungle and deserts of Africa, for instance, and treat people for horrible diseases that are no longer known in our country or even in a half-developed world. So those intimate friendships that we make to give people peace when we negotiate an agreement or let them have a democracy and freedom for the first time. We just finished our 100th troubled election. And in the treatment of diseases, those are the things that are much more vivid in my mind as far as an intimate relationship with other people is concerned.
Mr. President, we have a couple of current events questions for you. First, Cuba.
Okay.
The Mariel boat lift happened during your presidency in 1980. I remember covering the stories as a reporter in Miami. There was an open arms policy towards Cuban immigrants who were seeking political asylum. Now, things in Cuba haven't really changed much in regards to human rights violations and freedom of speech. In light of that, how do you feel about restoring diplomatic relations with Cuba?
I'm fully in favor of it, and it's long overdue, and I hope we'll lift the sanctions or embargo against the Cuban people as soon as we possibly can. When I went into office, that was one of my goals to accomplish, and Castro and I made a lot of progress. As a matter of fact, the last time I was in Cuba, a few months ago, I visited the former embassy of the United States, and there were about 300 people working there on behalf of our government in Cuba, and they have several hundred in Washington working for their government in our country. This is something that Castro and I arranged, and if he had kept his promises to me, we would have had full diplomatic relations 35-40 years ago.
And that has been the problem many times over, is keeping those promises. So that's why I think people are asking, are those promises going to be kept? And as for Cuba's people seeing the advantages of a free society, now they've already seen that with the European travelers, the Canadian travelers. How would it change if American travelers are there? Why do we think that there's going to be any change?
Well, when I became president, I lifted all the travel restraints on Americans. There was, for 4 years at least, Americans were free to go to Cuba whenever they wanted to. And that was put back on them by Ronald Reagan and his successors. But I thought it was better to promote democracy and freedom, to let the Cuban Americans go back when they wanted to and let other Americans visit there, to let the Cuban people see what freedom meant. And I think when we deprived Americans of a right to go to Cuba, the only country in the world that couldn't go to Cuba, by the way, then I think we gave the Castro brothers a chance to blame all of their economic problems and all of their political problems on the United States embargo and the fact that we wouldn't let people come down there. So I think we would have had a much quicker move toward democracy and freedom in Cuba had we let Americans go there whenever they wished.
You didn't tell the president, Marianne, that you were born in Havana.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I was. It's not as easy for me to go.
Well, I hope you'll be able to go soon. You can go when you want to, right?
I can go, but I just have to jump over many more hoops, and it's much more expensive for me to go than it is for my husband, Bob,
yeah,
or
she,
you.
She can get in there, Mr. President, but we're not so sure they let her back out. That's the problem.
I have to travel on a Cuban passport,
Marianne,
even though I'm a U.S. citizen.
If you get down and have a problem, you call me.
Okay.
And I'll talk to Raul, and I believe he'll let you out.
Thank you very much. I will definitely keep that in mind. Now, about the Confederate flag, does it only belong in a museum, as some now say?
I think so. I think the Confederate battle flag, as you know, was first introduced into South Carolina and Georgia and so forth after the Civil Rights Movement started. It was a reaction to the progress that Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks and Andy Young and them were making. So it was just an expression of white supremacy to a lot of people, to some white people, and to most of the black people. So I think it's time for us to put it in a museum, yes.
What about Donald Trump? Ultimately, what effect do you think he's going to have on the presidential election?
I think he gives the news media something to talk about.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I think that Fox News and CNN and MSNBC would probably shut down these days if it weren't for Donald Trump to talk about. But I think he's kind of a flash in the pan. You know, he's completely irrational. He has uninhibited. He doesn't have any restraints on what he says about other people, including his fellow Republicans. And when he makes stupid statements about immigrants causing all the crime and that sort of thing, it's just kind of an embarrassment.
President Jimmy Carter, the book, his 29th, is A Full Life, Reflections at 90. I know you still teach, you preach, you do woodwork, fish, you write poetry and paint. In fact, some of those paintings and poems are in this book. But I remember that you were an avid softball player. You probably don't do that anymore, do you?
I did until, I'd say, about 10 years ago. I played against my brother Billy when I was running for president, and when I went home from the White House while I was president. Billy led the news media team, and I led the Secret Service team, and we had a very close relationship. Both of us were pitchers, by the way.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then we had two teams that played in Plains for until about 10 years ago, and I pitched on my team. After Billy passed away, but I've always was a baseball player early on, and then a softball player later on, including when I was in the submarine force. I played hard pitch softball. The last few years, I played soft pitch.
Yeah, one time in Chicago, over at Channel 11 here, I gave you an official 16-inch Chicago softball. I remember you looked at it and you thought, well, what is this? But I'm sure that's on your mantle in Plains right next to the Nobel Prize today, isn't it?
Well, it may be in the Hall of Fame for baseball. I don't know. I sent one softball up there because they still have it in case somewhere.
By the way, you mentioned the media team playing softball, and you write in the book about the media coverage you had as president and how your efforts to woo the news media, as you say, were not successful. You had a lot of negative coverage, and you write that you never understood that. Have you ever figured that out, what you did that warranted that?
Well, part of it was that I was from the South. I was the first president, I think, in 148 years to be elected president from the Deep South. And when I ran, I got about 85% of the votes in Georgia, and I got about 75% of the votes in Tennessee, as a matter of fact. I remember that. But a lot of people in the North, including the Yankees around Washington, D.C., thought that somehow or another I had racist tendencies and they would break out sometime in the future. That was one of the reasons. And I never had been involved in national politics before. I ran directly from governor of Georgia, was kind of a small southern state, to be president of the United States, and a lot of them couldn't get over that. So, and then it was right after Watergate, and I believe a lot of the people thought they were going to be investigative reporters that would reveal some horrible scandal from my personal background or from my administration, and they were frustrated in that. So those are a few things that I think about, but we lived with it. We finally learned to ignore the negative aspect of news coverage, and a scholar did a survey of that. I think he's from University of Indiana, and he pointed out that 46 out of my 48 months in office, I had negative coverage.
Wow.
So anyway, I lived with it.
Mr. President, I know we have to let you go, but real quick, one last question. You've done so much in your life. What are you most proud of?
I kept the peace for our country for 4 years. We never dropped a bomb. We never launched a missile. We never fired a bullet. And we brought peace to many other people, between Egypt and Israel. And we started doing away with apartheid in South Africa. In Africa, we normalized relations with China. We solved a horrible confrontation over the Panama Canal. So we brought peace, and we also protected human rights. So I'd say those are the two things that make me most proud.
President Carter, you've had a truly remarkable life, and it's a remarkable book, A Full Life, Reflections at 90. Great talking to you, sir. Thank you, and continued good health and happiness to you and the entire Carter family. If Marianne has trouble in Cuba, we're going to call you, and I want to get down to Plains to talk softball with you.
We wish
I hope so. And by the way, how long have you two been married?
16 years. Oh, I shouldn't 16. Have. You know what? I should have let Bob answer that just to see what he would say.
Well, congratulations to you. So keep it up. You got a little way to go to catch me and Rosa.
I think so. So we send a lot of love to you and to your family. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Across. And I'm grateful to you.
And tomorrow, go ahead, Mr. President.
No, I said best wishes to you and all the folks around Chicago.
Jimmy Carter with us back in 2015. President Biden will deliver the eulogy at the funeral Thursday, and the eulogy written by Gerald Ford will be read by his son, Stephen.